Hello and welcome to Phoenix Cinema Podcast. I'm Chris Austin.
And I'm Luke Parker.
And we are so pleased to welcome a very special guest on the episode with us today. This guest is a BAFTA and Oscar-winning film composer for his score All Quiet on the Western Front, and has received BAFTA, Golden Globe, and Oscar nominations for his Lion and Conclave scores also. Or you may have heard his music recently on TV for his scores to the HBO Max series Dune Prophecy, which you can watch on Now in the UK, or The Day of the Jackal, which you can also watch on Now or on Peacock in the US. If you listen to this show, or if you know myself and Luke personally, you will know that we are massive fans of film music. And so with that, dear listeners, it is our utmost pleasure to welcome composer Volker Bertelmann to the Phoenix Cinema Podcast. Welcome.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Luke, for having me.
Oh, it is an absolute delight.
Absolute pleasure.
To have you with us today. We're beyond excited.
Yeah, we've been looking forward to this for a long time.
We really have. Yeah. We did a roundup of our favorite films and scores that we had covered on the podcast throughout 2024. Mm-hmm. And Luke here awarded best score to Volker Bertelmann for Conclave. So step on up, Luke. You may present your award. But no, it truly is an honor to have you join us today. Well, where are you joining us from, if I may ask?
I'm in Los Angeles right now.
Oh, okay. Love. Is that where you reside?
No. I'm living in Germany and in Düsseldorf.
Okay.
And I'm there most of the year, but this time, due to the all the nominations, we have a pretty busy schedule. And I'm a lot of times in London as well, because London has a lot of the films that I'm working on are mostly done in London. And I appreciate the city so much.
Absolutely. All right. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I guess I'll kick us off today by asking, because I'm so curious, a little about your background growing up and your musical journey. What was the music that you grew up with? What informed your tastes and interests?
Well, obviously that depends on the age, in the beginning I was pretty much in a very strong religious household. I would say very pure Protestant, maybe sometimes a little bit close to Mormon kind of religious culture. So men and women were sitting on different sides in the church and stuff like that. So that was quite a very strict surrounding where music was meant to be. You know, when there was enough bass in the music, it was maybe music from the devil, which I totally loved at that time. You know, I was just like, yes, you know.
Yeah. So if you're not allowed it, you'll embrace it. Yeah.
You embrace it. But I was always driven by bass and rhythm. I loved music always that was physical. So in a way, when I was maybe 12, I had my first band, and that was my school band in a way. But we were playing the Rolling Stones, Stones covers. We played a lot of music that was, at that time maybe known as crowd rock, or music that was pretty, long pieces, no breaks, a lot of guitar solos. Quite loud rock atmosphere. And I played keyboards, and because at that time keyboards were still cool in the 80s. In the 80s, they were getting a little bit uncool. But in that time, I was trying to find some friends or people that had at all synthesizers or, keyboards, because they were expensive, and I was 12 years old, so I had I had no instrument. And then I would say when I was getting older, like 16, 17, I was very interested in Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. And suddenly I really loved hip hop, and I was getting into this kind of like 80 BPM beats. A lot of the, at that time, you know, when I was 17, maybe, there was a specific German music movement called the German Wave or Deutsche Welle, which was pretty much driven by wave music and by, let's say punk, very raw and very simple guitar riffs. Mm. Funny lyrics, absurd lyrics sometimes even, and you could just jump around with music like that. And Nena 99 Red Balloons was one part of that time in a way.
I see.
You know, and of that movement in a way, because Nena's band was pretty much one of the top bands in that time. Mm-hmm. And then I in Kraftwerk with Model, for example, they were a part of that as well. And so in a way, that was also kind of, there was also electronic music involved, but I wasn't so deeply influenced by that. That came much later in my life. I would say around 30, I was suddenly getting in touch with like the independent electronic labels in Germany, specifically in Cologne. Compact was one label that was doing a lot of techno and minimal techno music, Berlin-based electronic music, music from England, FX Twin, guys that were doing like very like extraordinary music. In my hometown in Düsseldorf, there was at that time a band called Mouse on Mars. They were very, they did fantastic, quirky, weird electronic music. And I was always inspired by listening to them because they were so, there was no fear of releasing music that maybe other people think like, oh, what is that noise? We need a denoiser, you know? I would say I was growing up through all these genres. Classical music was always present, obviously, because of Bach, the chorals. We had a lot of classical performance in the church. So the whole first 20 years, there was always classical music as well involved.
In going back to what you were talking about when you were younger, maybe like your early teen years when you were kind of started playing around with these different genres, was there any sort of formal music education in parallel with that, or was it all kind of just as a hobby for fun?
No, it was actually, there was two things in my life happening. There was a very kind of memorable moment that I still know. That was when I was 9, and I was listening to with my mom. I was in the church, and there was a piano player playing Chopin. I think it was a nocturne. The guy played it so well that I said to my mom, I want to learn with this guy to play exactly that piece as he does. And my mom said, well, we don't have a piano, you know. So I said, but I want to learn piano with this guy. And then I was going on her nerves at a certain point. And then my grand aunt was giving us a piano because she had an instrument left that was quite, was not so well in shape, but it was enough that it kept the tuning for a couple of weeks. And then I learned on that piano, and I had exactly by that man piano lessons from the age of 9. And I learned obviously all the Chopin, Mozart, Beethoven pieces. But by the age of 12, when I was suddenly had that band and I saw that girls are loving to come to the rehearsal room, which was on the countryside, something that was, there was not many places where you could meet as young kids. I mean, boys and girls, they had hardly no place rather than on the whatever soccer field or, in places where it was bloody cold. We decided to have, to rent a own rehearsal space. I put all my pocket money in renting that space. And I played a lot of pieces by ear. So I had a tape recorder on my knees. I remember it was an old recorder from a company called Zaba, which did like this, you know, and I had to, I always pressed return and I said, oh, what kind of chords are these? I have to figure it out. And whenever I felt like, oh, this chord is exactly what he plays, I was, it was a delighted moment. And obviously my teacher was not a big fan of, you know, me fiddling around with chords and cue sheets and let's say music sheets that are based on chords. But what happened for me was I was very practiced in just reading letters, like let's say G major, and I knew exactly, you know, I found out different styles of playing G major, and that's why I think I was getting deeper into the improvisational music and, you know, writing songs, you know, looking at other people, how their songs sound like, and then I try to make a song of my own in the same style. I copied maybe things at that time. And, you know, with 20, I think I was a pretty good pianist and keyboard player, and I was sometimes playing then with other bands. They hired me. I could earn some money, but I never studied music. It was mainly all on a very, let's say, down-to-earth level of learning.
Interesting. This man who taught you from the church, does he have any idea today who you are and where your career has gone?
Well, no, he actually died when I was still, I would say, doing other, I was studied medicine. And so I did a lot of other things before I, you know, I started in a way to,
I see,
to find myself in a place where I felt like, okay, this is actually what I was always waiting for in terms of making music, you know? So he was already gone by then.
Oh, I see. I see.
It's interesting that you say that you started studying medicine. And I'm just wondering, at the point that you made that choice, had you ever like considered a career in music?
Yeah, I had, but I had not found, I didn't have the opportunity to find the right spot for me. Ideologically, like I didn't know, I wasn't sure if I want to be a band member or if I want to have a pop career and go on tour, a world tour, which I somehow hated, like being away from home for so long, you know, and also repeating the program over and over again. That was something that that made me somehow sad and depressed. So I said, no, that's not something for me. But then, you know, when I wanted to study, I went once to the MIT in Los Angeles and just looked in, you know, if I could study there. And I felt it was a great institution, but it didn't felt like that's something when I go there, I will learn more. You know, and I didn't saw myself there. So somehow I always went back to some very traditional job options because first of all, I needed money. And secondly, I felt I hadn't found at that time also the record label. You know, I had the Sony Music record deal, which is for a lot of musicians already a dream of having a major record deal. And, but I had it and I just felt like there's something weird about those deals because they don't really look at your person. They just look at the product and they want to have the next single. And if you don't function, they just fire you.
Right.
You know, and that was something my whole opinion about life is not based on functionality. It's much more based on trust. And of on maybe finding the right people around you that you love to work with. And I think once that finds its realization, I would say then suddenly everything works.
How did your family feel about you pursuing this music career? You said you were from a very strict religious background. Were they a bit concerned or were they supportive?
Well, my mom and I have five siblings. We all do different. We have all done different things. My parents were obviously a little bit skeptical, but in a very loving way. So I have to say they were the most people that I would say taught me a lot in terms of loving other people, loving your family, you know, supporting people, having patience, you know, trusting sometimes, also overcoming your fear. Because what they did, in a way, at some point, they felt like they maybe had not the overview of what I really wanted to do, because they were born before the Second World War. I mean, in 1931, the topics were completely different. I mean, they were just, you know, they were just focused on surviving. Mm-hmm. In a way. And when then a young guy comes in and says, hey, I bought an instrument, I will be a rock star, and I will look like the Beatles at some point, they were like, what, are you kidding me? Long hair and white trousers, or, you know, they would freak out at that moment. But later, when I won the Oscar, my father and my mom, they received so many, you know, messages and phone calls from their village. And my father went on the market, and sometimes I met him, and he had a long list of people that were greeting me. And he was just like, he you could see how suddenly this whole circle of our journey, in a way, unfolded in a very beautiful way, because they suddenly realized, oh, okay, this guy was already on a mission when he was 9, but we didn't recognize that.
Yeah. It's almost like vindication in a way. Such an incredible reward. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm an actor myself, and when I do have a child, if they ever came to me and said that's what they wanted to do, I would be terrified. Mm. I mean, I'm really hoping they don't, you know, because it's such a hard journey. But again, you are a perfect example of just having the courage to undertake it, and the talent, of course, and who knows where it could take you in the end. That's incredible. Am I pronouncing this right? Hauschka.
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about for you? Is that like a pseudonym that you initially started out with?
Yeah, well, that was the first time I found the thing that I really am. You know, in a way, and Hauschka was, in a way, a band name. I wanted to release piano records, but I wanted to release them under no pressure of being the pianist. I wanted to have a kind of band that is maybe, or a name that is not, you know, showing you if I'm a woman or a man, or if we are 10 or 12. And sometimes people, you know, when I arrived at concerts with my sound man and my light guy, they said, "And where's the band?" And I said, "It's just me." It's just me. You know, so that showed me it quite worked, because I wanted to, you know, a lot of the things that we are doing, it doesn't matter if music or acting or you do, you know, podcasts or whatever, they are occupied with expectations. So, and you very easily can, just by names or how you place things, you can create an expectation that you don't want to fulfill, because you are still, you want to find your own language. And if you have the possibility of being anonymous for a certain amount of time, you can actually start finding out what is the things that you really feel are strong. And Hauschka was, for me, in a way, that kind of, I felt somehow protected. I had the feeling I can do anything I want. I can, if I find in the process something that is a broken electronic guitar and that is my instrument, then that's it, you know, and nobody, I don't care. And it really helped me to cut loose of my own expectations as well, and just say, go ahead and just do what you like. And if people really like you, they will come to the concerts. But if it's something that is your own hobby and people are not coming, you have to work in a different field. You know, you have to go to, you have to, whatever, be a waiter, or you have to do something else. You have to invent yourself again. And when I found that, I already felt that I was supporting an Icelandic band, Moom, which is a wonderful band. And they were, at that time, Hildur Gudnatudir was one of the band members. She was a cellist.
Oh, wow.
And so I was opening for them at that time. So they took me to on an American tour, and we did the first show in New York, and I sold all my merch on the first day of the whole tour. So all the records were gone.
Wow.
You know, and when you feel that suddenly without, like, you know, we had not massive promotion. It was a couple of posters in the, you know, even maybe they didn't know my name. But when you feel suddenly you play and people are like, oh my God, who is that? We want to buy something. That was for me like the first reaction where I felt, okay, everything I did before that was somehow just not fake, but it was something that needed always like a lot of convincing energy, a lot of I had to push. The record company had to put thousands and thousands of my money, which I didn't know, you know, which went on my bill. They were spending that just to convince people to come to the concerts, and I was like, oh man, this is completely wrong. You need in a way something that functions in a way first in itself, and Hauschka was the first thing that worked like that.
It's so interesting. Yeah, I think there was an author, I can't remember hearing this story, a female author who was releasing her books under a pseudonym, and it can't for the life of me, it's escaping now, but the reason she did it, hugely successful author, very successful books, she didn't want anyone to approach her books with this, like you said, expectation or stigma of this is a male author, this is a female author, this is whomever. You just, it's about the product that you're selling. And she was able to hide behind, it protected her, this anonymity. That really reminds me of that. That's fascinating. And with Hauschka, sometimes you use that name for film scores and sometimes you don't. Is there a difference between the two, or do you only use Hauschka for certain things, like an alter ego?
That has changed since 2017. Since I was when I was nominated for a Lion with my good friend Dustin O'Halloran, we were both we did everything, all the interviews and everything. And I found out that it's very difficult for people who write about film music to talk about Hauschka. I mean, they don't know who you are. They always ask, how can we talk to you? Do we have to name you Hauschka, or do we have to say, do you Volker? So there was a lot of questions of identity where I felt in this case, it's not so helpful.
I see.
You know, it needs... also, I felt that if I do more film scores and I'm doing less records, because until 2017, I nearly did every year a record. And I really worked, you know, a lot, and I really loved it. But then I felt at some point I need to find a different way of making music as well when I'm at home, because I can't go always on tour, you know. I felt burnt out a little bit from the traveling, and also, I mean, at that time I was already 2017. I was already 51, you know, which means you are not anymore in an age where you just say up. I don't care. I will, you know. Yeah, you also think about how can I somehow also take care of myself, and you know, having a, you know, enjoying the life and not being stressed all the time. So. When I did Lion and I found out that this doesn't work, from Lion onwards, no score is released under Hauschka anymore. So all the other scores, and we tried also to, we split the Spotify account and, you know, use Hauschka as one part and use Volker Bertelmann as one, because it's also swamping your artistic career. You are, you know, and I don't say that in a negative way. Film scores have a very high value for me. I love them so much. They are not a necessity. I really love working on them, but they are a complete different genre. You know, because I have to work with collaborators. And if we find out that the most cheesy string music is the solution, I'm doing it. It's not like, I'm not like, no, I'm not doing it. It's just more, it gives me also a lot of pleasure, you know, to say, hey, I can be someone else. Great. You know, I don't have to fulfill the Hauschka agenda in a way. And at the same time, I can go back to Hauschka and do concerts, release records that are nerdy. I can play in small places where actually only nerds go.
Like us.
And it's not piling up with. I don't have to drive with a truck. I don't have to have a huge, operation. I can just take a suitcase and fly wherever I am and wherever I want. You know.
Yeah, this was something I really wanted to ask you. You know, you kind of have these two sides to your career, in like your experimental solo projects and now with your like commercial film scoring. I really wanted to know how you balance those two worlds and if there's something and if there's something one offers you creatively that the other doesn't, if that makes sense.
The last part of your question I didn't understand.
Like, what does, is there something that each offers you creatively that maybe the other one doesn't?
So you feel like if both sides are living from each other a little bit or getting, you know, having an advantage. Honestly, I'm still learning to handle both sides because since I'm working a lot in film school, I haven't released so many records again. And before that, I only released records heavily and I didn't have any, like a lot of scores. So in a way, at the moment, I'm trying to balancing things out and see whenever I feel, when can I do the next record and can I have, do I want to invest time into touring and where do I want to play? And, you know, but what those two sides are profiting from each other is that the film scores are profiting from the possibility that I'm independent. And actually not only the film scores, I also but benefit from that because I feel, you know, every now and then I'm feeling like, hey, I don't need actually to do this because I can actually make a record myself. And I can go on tour if I want to. Obviously, you have to take care of that because there might be, in 10 years' time, a period where I can't say that anymore. You know, people are not coming to my shows. But at the same time, the independent feeling is something that also makes other people interested because they are not interested in somebody who's depending on something.
That's such a good point.
And if you are depending, they just say, oh, I don't know, maybe we'll give him the job. But if you are independent, they are like, oh, we have to make sure he's in town. Oh, we have to make sure we get him. You know, things like that. So the psychological element behind that is a very interesting thing, which is obviously driven by, in myself, driven by fearlessness. If I'm fearless and I feel like I'm independent, I can always rely on what I can do, I'm fine. A lot of times, and I have to say that in everyone's life, I guess, there are periods where you're totally scared of losing the job or having no money, maybe having a very weird perspective in front of you, and you're in a way starting to hold on what you have very tightly and you can't really get cut loose and you're feeling you're depending on something so much that you don't get the chance from others, and that's a kind of circle. And somehow you have to break that circle up into something where you just start to fly again, and then everything unfolds quite nicely. And so that is one advantage of being an independent musician. And the other way around, I love actually the collaborations with other people and following their vision. Sometimes even myself is going in the background just as a, you know, in the negative way, I would say as a service person. But I like serving. You know, I like actually sometimes not thinking too much about the content. Obviously, I feel the content and I say yes to something. I prove the content beforehand. But once I'm on it, I sometimes like actually to fulfill someone's vision. Mm-hmm. And that's a very, it's a wonderful process when you are fine with it. If you always want to be ego, then that doesn't work.
I was just going to say, I mean, I love that you said that, and it rings so true to me. I mean, it's so funny when you go into an audition face to face or what have you, mm-hmm. the ones that I really desperately want, I really mm-hmm. want it. In fact, I kind of need this. Mm-hmm. I never get that callback.
Yeah.
But when I get the job, I thought, this one, kind of don't really care about this one. Sure, I'll take it. My heart's not fully in it. I can take it or leave it. I'll show up and do it. All of a sudden, they're leaning in and I book mm-hmm. the job.
Yeah.
So it's a fascinating. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I just wanted to ask if, is there anything in particular that draws you to a potential project in terms of film scoring?
Well, I'm a big fan of different genres. I mean, I love when something is pretty much, let's say, a thriller. I love thrillers. I was always loving watching films when I'm at the edge of my seat. I love emotional films, you know, when they are really impactful. I think a lot of times films can have a lot of, like Conclave has quite a wide range of those genres in itself, and which I think is also the reason why it maybe resonates with so many people, because it has a very clear message. It's very emotional, but it's also very it has a lot of suspense and tension, so you are really enjoying the cinematic moment, but you're not dull at the end of the day, because you're like whatever visual effects just destroyed your synapses. I'm a big fan of fantasy worlds as well, yeah, but it has a different, you have to be differently prepared, and I think there is a lot of films where that I somehow consume, but I don't go back to them. And Conclave, for example, is a film where I go back. I somehow feel like I have to take people by the hand and say, you have to see that mm-hmm. somehow. You know?
And it's so funny because, yes, Conclave can be really tense, suspenseful, dark, and in the same moment, hilarious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And your score somehow finds this balance between mm-hmm. the two, and I mm-hmm. find that exactly what that mix of genres so compelling. It's a very mm-hmm. fine line, and mm-hmm. you all walk it really, really perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's because we are big fans of fine lines. I mean, it's really, you have to surf at the edge, and at the same time, whenever you fall down, you have to make sure that it's not, you know, just one step on the side can destroy everything that you've done beforehand. So you have to very fine-tune it. And I think that's what you said, Luke, or what you asked Luke beforehand. That's really, I would say, something that I try to find in films when I read the script or when I talk to somebody, to the director. I get a sense for, okay, this person is very interesting and tells me exactly like things that I, not that I want to hear, but where I mean, you know, as we know, in the first minute, a lot of times you decide for a person or you don't, mm-hmm. even though you don't know, but there's something that straight away clicks and you're like, okay, that is interesting. This person I really appreciate. I think that this is uncomplicated. In 90% that works for me and my judgment, 10% are sometimes different.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the hardest jobs where you like someone, but it gets complicated, because that is always, in a way, that, you know, is a very painful process, because you at one point you want to say, you know, I'm leaving. Mm-hmm. And at the same time you say, come on, let's finish.
Let's figure this out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, how did film scoring come about for you? Were you always a big film fan growing up? Did you always find yourself noticing and taking an interest in film music, or was that something you sort of discovered and grew an ear for later?
No, I was always, I mean, in the village where I grew up with nine, I had already a kind of boys club with five boys that we always met. We met together on a Friday afternoon and we just planned activities. I still have a kind of little folder with invitation. We actually typed invitations on the typewriter, like this Friday at 2:30. We're meeting at that place and we're going to the cinema. And then, you know, we just, we could have said that in school, but we did it like in an official kind of membership way, you know? And the cinema that was close to our, to my home village was always getting the prize for the best program cinema in Germany. And it was run by one very passionate person who brought to that very provincial town always the best movies. So we went there and, you know, we saw, I would say, the first movies that I saw was like Indiana Jones, Once Upon a Time in the West, you know, things like that, like films that were, in a way, you know, staying with me. The scores were staying with me. It was funny because recently I met Harrison Ford, and he was the one that was the first, one of the first actors, and he was actually, you know, I met him by accident in the backstage of the you know, of the Oscar, when I was winning the Oscar. He was congratulating, he passed me and he said, hey, congratulations. And I said to him, I'm such a big fan because you were one of the first people that I, you know, I saw on celluloid.
That's crazy.
In a
way. Yeah. You know?
So in a way, that time I was fascinated by it, but I was not thinking about being a film composer until the age of 18, because when I was 18, I did my first TV series, but just one episode. And that was just a random occasion because the guitar player of our school band had parents that were directors, and they were needing source music for the radios and for, you know, the car driving and all that, and so we gave them the pieces that him and me wrote, and we received our first, I mean, the payments for it, because that was a very successful series in the world. We received so much money over the years that I could finance sometimes, you know, time in the during my student times. I had, you know, sometimes I got a paycheck from the royalty company and I was like, oh my God, this is, you know, it's also like some, like surprises. You never think, you always think it will be £2.50, you know?
sure.
And then suddenly something comes in that is bigger and you're like, great, I can buy a synthesizer or I can buy some speakers. So I think the connection of that world with music was fascinating for me. But I lost the memory a little bit about that for a while because I was practically not, I was in different worlds, you know, I was traveling through different time zones in a way. And suddenly when I got asked to do my next cinema movie, and every now and then I was thinking about it, but it was very hard to find a job like that.
Well, you've spoken about him already, and I wanted to touch on this because I always find it fascinating when, in any artist's career, when ongoing collaborations seem to be formed. And I know as an actor, there's no greater feeling than working alongside someone who you feel just gets you and pushes you and challenges you to be greater and to maybe stretch outside of your comfort zone. Mm-hmm. And you've collaborated with American composer Dustin O'Halloran on a number of projects together, with Lion in particular being nominated for everything as a result of that collaboration. Mm-hmm. How did that come about, meeting and continuing to work with each other?
Well, we met each other the first time when I was on tour in Italy, in an area called Reggio Emilia, and I was there playing a concert, and I received a message from a friend saying, hey, there's a musician who would like to meet you because he's interested in prepared piano. And that was already 2005, maybe. I said, yeah, no problem. He can come. And so he came with a sound engineer, Francesco Donadello, who's now quite a well-known. He was also a drummer at that time in an Italian mm-hmm. band. And his manager, so they were three, and they came in, and I had a sound check, and I just prepared an upright piano, which is quite difficult to do, but I made it work. We made a sound check, and then he said to me, I'm working right now on a score for Marie Antoinette, and I would love to maybe incorporate some prepared piano, and I was interested if you could show me how that works. And I said, I could show you everything. Mm-hmm. So I took time, and we just spent 2 hours looking into the piano, and I explained everything to him. And at the end, I think there was no secrets in my work. I just explained what I'm doing, and then I played the performance. And then after that, he said, maybe you're so good at it, I'm not sure if I can do it. I can work in the same way. And I said, well, that's not you have to find your own path with it, And I think from that conversation onwards, first of all, we had the same manager from that point of time onwards, because Tim, who was there, was becoming my manager as well. And then we both were suddenly on Fat Cat, on the label from Brighton, including Johan Johansson, who was there as well on that label. And then we did a tour together, like Johan, Dustin, and me. Max Richter was there at that time as well. So we were all the Max was at that time coming a couple of times to my festival in Düsseldorf, where I invited him. So we had always a very close relationship in terms of meeting each other on a very, let's say, musical band level, but quite low in terms of it was not like the Royal Albert Hall,
Sure.
it was there. It was still like little clubs, little venues. We felt all, I think, that people loved our music, and then something was growing. And I think then somewhere in 2009, the article was released at the Guardian about neoclassical music, and we were in a way in that group of seven or eight pianists that were mentioned. And we all, at least some of them I talked to, I don't know if everyone felt the same, but at least some, a few of them were feeling like, okay, that's now we have to leave the ship. because it felt like a gravestone. You suddenly get this kind of, okay, here's the gravestone. Thank you. You're done for this life.
That's it now. Yeah.
That's it. And we're like, no, that's... let's don't go there. And then in a way, everybody was searching for his own place. And when we got offered the film Lion, Dustin and me, that was the first collaboration we did together. And I knew him already. He was at that time already one of my best friends. He was at my wedding. So when Garth Davis was asking me and saying, hey, could you imagine to work with somebody? I said, no. I can't work with someone else. It's too complicated. It's too complicated. Why should I? I mean, it's already complicated to work with a director in terms of finding the right tonality. No, this is not right. Can you do some more? Can you do some revisions? No, this is wrong. And so on. And you are like, you're constant in a kind of, oh, I have to go back to the studio. I have to write things again. Mm-hmm. And then if you have then somebody else who's complicated next to you saying, let me do this. No, I'm doing it. Then you have another battleground in front of you.
Right.
So I said, no, I really would love to do that by myself. And then he said, but who is it? Because maybe there is a, I'm interested. Who are you thinking about? And he said, Dustin. And I said, okay, well, then that's a different case. I would love to work with him. And so we both, I also have to say that was my fourth film, big film ever, which means I didn't know what Pro Tools is or what a program is. I didn't know what a cue sheet was at that time. I had to learn a new program. I had to go to Los Angeles to understand how people here work, how you work with a big orchestra, how what a music editor is, all these things I had to learn in that process. And Dustin was a fantastic collaborator and teacher in that sense, that he, in a way, was helping me and, treating me like a friend. And obviously that went so well that we afterwards we got more offers as a duo. But at the same time, it was also necessary for both of us to have our own career independently ongoing, because you never know. I mean, if you only get hired as a duo because you're the duo, I can break my arm and suddenly we are not a duo anymore, then you have to somehow, and I'm not saying that doesn't mean that was not worth it. Every score was worth it that we did together, and we will maybe do things again together. There's no reason why we are not doing it at the moment. But, we found actually our own lives at the moment that are occupying us. So that's all good.
I really hope you do work together again. Yeah, the track Fossils that you and Dustin composed from the film Ammonite is truly beautiful. It's one of those pieces of music that just communicates with your soul and almost takes on its own life separate from the movie itself. Lovely. And I have to say, talking to film music fans, the idea of Bertelmann, O'Halloran, Johansson, Richter all moving in the same circles is blowing our mind right now.
Yeah, I mean, you can see that in a lot of historical, let's say when you look backwards to the 20s and you go to France or to Paris and you see how painters and composers were so close to each other, and you never thought that this was working. That's obviously, I would say a natural way of people who are working together are somehow also, getting in touch with each other, or who are, let's say, similar in their, or they play on the same festivals, and then they decide, hey, and you have the same thing with bands. If you go deeper into your favorite band history, you will maybe find that they were all like hanging out together, and maybe they played even in the band beforehand, and they were the bass player, but then they left, something like that,
Right. Yeah, just like Gwanadóttir being in this Icelandic band that you opened for. I mean, it's
We even did a record then together, which was recorded at King's Place. Hildur and me, which is called Pantone, and so there's all these moments where you meet and then you like each other and you say, hey, why don't we do something together? And a lot of times you say that, but there's no time. And sometimes suddenly you realize, that works, and you have suddenly a moment of collaborations and something that is worth to be released.
Absolutely.
I think so. Another one of your regular collaborators is Edward Berger, who you've done quite a few films with now.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if there is something about the composing process on his projects that you particularly enjoy that keeps you coming back to working with him.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's first of all always a relationship that has to be wanted from both sides. It's something that you can't actually request to have a collaboration with someone.
Yeah.
It's rather a kind of, let's say, unwritten agreement where you just feel like, okay, this is great that we work together and I'm really benefiting not only music-wise, I also love hanging out with someone like him, or, I'm profiting from in all sorts of levels from that relationship. And I think that's maybe the first thing I would say is that we have a great relationship. A relationship that is, besides making music for a film or him being a filmmaker, that we, personally enjoy, spending time with each other, which is important when you are deeply involved in something. What I really enjoy about him is that he's encouraging the positive aspects of work first. That is extremely helpful, and I can highly recommend that, because I'm doing the same thing, which is you first mention the things that are working before you start criticizing the things that are not working, because that gives the other person the feeling of strength in the moment when you receive things that you might pull you back a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But this is very important for inner growth. And if you have someone who actually wants to grow with you on all sorts of levels, this is the ideal situation. I mean, and that's why we are, in a way, working so well with each other, because every film gives us a new perspective on film music and finding, and there's no limits in terms of expectations. There is an expectation that says, we want to do something different, and let's surprise ourselves in a way, and let's look at the film, what it really needs. And that doesn't mean like, oh, we worked last time like this, so let's do that again.
Sure.
You know, it's at the same time, as you maybe know for your own job, you have to trick yourself sometimes to not getting lazy with things that are working. So you say, we do it exactly like the last time, it works so well. And then you do it twice, and then you're bored of your own system in a way, and you're like, oh, again. And then as I said with a neoclassical label, you can feel the death already coming. So in a way, what is important is to redefine yourself all the time, and you can't do that with everyone. Some people, and a lot of times the reason why that is that the process, and that doesn't mean for me that the director is the one, it's also me being triggered to have fear. A lot of things that are fear driven are not working.
Right.
And so what you need is, in a way, to find a collaborator that encourages you to be have courage and go forward and finding new ideas. And even when you think, oh, I can't present that, that's maybe too weird, says, what is it?
Yes.
Show it. Let's give me an idea what weird is. Yeah. Mm. What is your weird? Maybe your weird is something that
is my normal. Yeah.
Is my normal. And I want to make you even more, facing what your limits are. I want to see where and I don't mean that in an extreme way of pain. I mean that much more in a way of going deeper in, your ability to unleash the things that are really wonderful and strong, but maybe they are covered. And that's where I feel the collaboration with him is working very well.
It's incredible that you say that. Yeah, because I mean, we did an episode on Conclave because the Phoenix Cinema was screening it. And I said to Luke, I said, it's incredible how different this film is to All Quiet on the Western Front.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you couldn't be more different. Mm-hmm. And so you've done All Quiet on the Western Front together, for which, of course, you won the Oscar for it. And huge congratulations to you for that, sir.
Thank you.
An absolutely brilliant film. Mm-hmm. And now Conclave, for which you've been nominated again. And I believe there's an upcoming film in which you're working together again, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And I'm really hoping that there's some sort of director-composer collaboration shaping up here in the vein of a Spielberg-Williams, for instance.
Well, I'm not scared about that, and I think the circumstances are good for at least for a longer relationship, and you know, and that means also you have to make sure that you are always honest and finding even things that are maybe in the first place not understandable. You have to step back and just say, okay, I see the life sometimes, you know, maybe let's say there will be films maybe where I'm not on the list and then mm-hmm. I will be back. But it's always important that you take care of yourself and preparing you for the moments where you just feel like, okay, I'm independent mm-hmm. In a way that I can always follow. Work with someone for a long time means you need independence as a counterpart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. and I think that's for me like something where I feel that we have at least the wish of, you know, making as many films as possible, you know, together.
I love that about it's like the theme of what you've been saying this whole time, this base for you of independence.
Mm-hmm.
You will always have that. Whether this project works out for you or not, it doesn't matter because you'll always have a base to fall back on for yourself.
Yeah.
I think that is such an important lesson for anyone listening, for any aspiring film composers or artists out there. I think that's so lovely.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say as well, how much does the accolades and awards and praise affect you when jumping into your next project together? Because for instance, that's two for two now in terms of Oscar nominations and recognition from major awards bodies when mm-hmm. scoring an Edward Berger movie. Mm-hmm. Going into the third movie together, do you think to yourself, shit, this needs to be good. There'll be an expectation now or not at all?
I would say we always felt like we are going into a film and it has to be good.
Mm.
There's hardly no, I'm not really thinking about the awards or the praises that we got for the other films.
Okay.
The only thing is that I obviously get maybe a confidence that things that I'm doing are somehow resonating on a wider scope, and also that there is a love for music as well that is not only flourishing and, you know, being a kind of wallpaper music in the background, that there is also acknowledgement for music that also has maybe a conceptual idea or maybe a minimalistic idea, and that doesn't mean that this is my trademark in a way. I've done last year so many movies that are really in a way working as in the very traditional sense of music and genre in a way. And I really love having that as a, actually looking at something that is on my table and say, I think this needs this. Mm-hmm. And then I'm starting to do that. Not like, okay, I think this needs me in my way I'm doing things I don't know how, let's say a bagpipe works, but I would love to train me to be a bagpipe player to make music for that movie. Mm-hmm. So, which actors do always, they change their body, they prepare for a role with whatever, they learn sword fighting, they suddenly jump out of a plane, they do all these things just to get an experience for the next role.
Mm-hmm.
And I think musicians have to do the same. You have to somehow inhale the spirit of the film and the idea, and then you have to find the language, and that can be very simple. And then in my work with Edward, I have the feeling that we found a formula that works very well with mm-hmm. his extreme well-made pictures, you know, the kind of framing, how the film is, you know, presented. I mean, it's so, it doesn't need music at all to be powerful.
You already know it's going to look magnificent.
Yeah. Yes. And that's something that is very, that is obviously very helpful. And in a way, you know, all the acknowledgement that you get is always obviously depending on, it's not only me. It's as a musician, I know you will never receive acknowledgement for something, for a film that is very unpopular, even though it might be the best music at all. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not working. Right. So it's always a connection of all the crafts. And so I feel, you know, the awards are somehow giving you a good feeling, obviously, in terms of the resonance outside. But you always have to go in the woods with your dog and just, you know, do what you normally do. And, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. cook a proper soup. And just
keep your feet on the floor. Yeah.
And do the things that are warm and, you know, go into the pub, have a proper pint with someone, you know, meet the lad from your neighborhood, you know. Things Absolutely. Like that are very, mm-hmm. very grounding and are very helpful in not getting too absorbed by something that is important and wonderful. But you can only feel it as wonderful if you are not changing your personality to the dark side, you know.
Right. Mm-hmm. Oh well, I mean, look, I'm conscious that we're getting on here, and I want to let you go. I have about a million more questions for you, but I'll ask you one more thing, which has kind of been I've been thinking about too. Is so you score a lot of TV series, and mm-hmm. one of the TV series that you've scored is Dune Prophecy. Mm-hmm. Which premiered in November of last year. Dune is obviously such a massive property, and it comes out the same year as Dune Part 2 mm-hmm. as a prequel to both Villeneuve movies to make it even more timely and relevant to those films. Mm-hmm. How was it taking this project on? Did you feel an obligation to sonically have it grounded in the same world as that of Zimmer's score for the films, or mm-hmm. did you just go your own way with it?
No, I think that was, I mean, I love, you know, I love the work of Hans. So, I mean, you know, he's a wonderful composer, wonderful human being, I think. Mm. And my feeling is a little bit that if you say yes to something like that, it needs to be very clear from the first moment, if that is something that is connected with his work or that is a complete independent project. And in this case, it was straight away, even though I didn't even ask, it was already said, no, we really want to have a different world in that film. But at the same time, you look at it, but you also feel straight away that his approach is definitely for the movie.
Right,
you know,
right.
For a wide scope and a wide range of the different pictures, while the series is much more a story like, you know, an internal, like a kind of family story. It's, you know, and that is maybe the advantage of the series, that it brings you much more personal connection to the stories of each individual, while a cinema movie has obviously the chance of just, you know, making montages with a lot of great shots and you can put music under it and it feels already like you're in a, you know, in an adventure park,
right,
you know, watching, maybe you're in the world of that time, you know. And I would say the series is much more focused on maybe feeling, oh, I could live there with that family as well, or something like mm-hmm. that. So the music needed a much more smaller approach. And I was very happy about that, that there was a opportunity for me to also practice. I mean, I see these, you know, saying yes to a film, and that sounds maybe a little bit, Yeah, he takes Dune for practicing. But it's actually, you know, it's actually every series in a way feels like has a lot of components you have to work with. And it's very interesting to understand how something works in terms of what is needed. How can you actually finish it? How can you find a traction in the process? Because you're coming with a blank paper and you have to somehow bring something on the table where people say, oh, this is exactly what we need. This is the theme. Right, you know, right. I'm not coming in with the themes beforehand, mostly when I'm, you know. So in a way, you have a contract and then you have to fulfill that. And that means like somehow you have to learn to deal with all the circumstances and all the wishes that I mentioned. And of course, leading also the direction in the moment where it's needed to be led. And then in other places, you have to step back and say, okay, that's your decision. You have to have to decide what you want to do. And so that was a very interesting process. Specifically, I mean, Dune has 6 episodes of an hour and it has 6 hours of music.
when it got renewed for season 2, were you like, oh, yay, oh, shit.
No, I was really like, oh, yeah, because, I mean, that means for me, I have already created a world that I can rely on, and I know how even they might say, I even don't know if I will do it. I mean, you know, we'll see who will be asked or if somebody asked me again. But there's a chance that they might ask me. And if that is the case, I would always say that's great because I have already, and I would say that's an advantage of anyone who works long on a series is that obviously you are so deep in it. And at the same time, it can actually absorb you so much that you are not anymore able to do anything else. You're just always in the in a certain world, you know. I actually felt like when that is mentioned in the press for that was the same for Day of the Jackal, when things like that are mentioned in the press, that means that the film was a success,
right?
And that is for me like the most wonderful news, because in a way you know, you sit with it for a long time, and for not only for me, I mean for everyone who's involved, that means so much. And I saw many films I was involved with that had just a weekend in the cinema and then they boom, you know, they were gone. And leaves also scars, you know.
Was it me?
What did we do wrong? Or was it the distribution? Or, you know, there's a lot of questions suddenly rising, and sometimes it's not the right time,
you know. Well, come what may, you made your stamp in that world, and that's incredible. And I'll just leave it. So me and Luke, we go to film concerts all the time. I'm just going to say Conclave would be a great live-to-picture concert at a venue like the Royal Albert Hall. I'm just going to plant that seed.
Well,
okay.
I'll let you know when it's time.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. Well, Volker, I just want to say a huge thank you to you for taking the time out of what surely must be a very busy schedule for you. We greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been such a pleasure listening to you talk about your career.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much.
It really has. Yeah. The best of luck to you for the upcoming BAFTAs and Oscar ceremonies. Best believe we will be cheering you on. We cannot wait to keep listening to your music and all the best for whatever comes next.
Oh, thank you so much. And have a wonderful day.
And you, sir, and you. All right, folks, that's it from us. Until next time, a special thanks reserved for Phoenix Cinema, who allow us the opportunity to do this for their wonderful venue. Our music is composed by Stefan Krieger. Check out more of his stuff at stefan-krieger.com. And our episodes are put together by Noah Anderson. Once again, a huge thank you to Volker Bertelmann. You can find his music on any streaming platform. I highly recommend it. Or just go and watch one of the many things he scored for an even greater appreciation of his work. In fact, Conclave is still screening at Phoenix Cinema. So how about you head to the Phoenix Cinema to watch it, and I'll meet you there.